I suppose I thought I'd just start with the like basic thing that I think is very important in understanding the method of the of Marxism and the group that we're part of, his Solidarity, and it's called historical materialism. And that's when you want to look at any particular social system, whether it's throughout history or today, crucial to understanding all of the dynamics that are bound up in that system is at the core the system of production that's operating within that, you know, within that society. And the reason for that's a very basic one, and that's that in order to exist as human beings, we actually have to make ourselves. It says we're organic beings, we have to produce ourselves from the environment that's around us. And that process is a social one. It's one that we don't just carry out on our own, but we're reliant on the society that's around us and the people that are around us. We need to eat, we need shelter, we need clothing. Those are absolute prerequisites for anything, for any art, for any politics, you must have that as a solid foundation. So how that process happens, how human beings actually craft themselves from their environment, you know, and what the system is that takes place is absolutely foundational within Marxism and within historical materialism. And under capitalism, when you're talking about what's wrong with capitalism today, there's a very, very basic thing that shapes everything else, and that's that the vast majority of humanity, the working class, as I said, the most people in the world are actually separated from the means of production. We don't actually have any means at our disposal to make ourselves or to cooperate socially. We don't have access to those resources. The system of production, the productive resources in society, are owned and controlled by a tiny minority that we call the capitalist class. And in order for us to live, in order for us to exist, we are required to sell our labour to the capitalist class in order to survive. So that's the, you know, that's at the core of Marx's understanding of what's wrong with capitalism. There's some obviously very profound implications from this, you know, from this particular setup and the way it goes. The first is the psychological impact of actually being alienated from the means of production, of actually not being able to have any control over that process of making yourself that is known as the labour process. You know, our entire identity, our whole being, our whole sense of ourselves is bound up in how we interact with the world, how we make ourselves from the world, how we creatively labour on the world. But we have no control. We have no resources at our disposal that actually allow us to do that. If we want to access those resources, it's got to be, you know, we've got to go to the capitalists and it's got to be on their terms. The decisions about what is done with the productive resources are made by that class. You know, they're not made, you know, in any way by workers. So being separated from the means of production, you're in very many ways, you're actually separated from yourself. You're cut off from your, you know, the true nature of your being and the true nature of the social, you know, being that you're that you're part of. So that's a very, you know, profound implications in terms of, you know, the very high rates of mental illness that we see in society, the depressions that we all fall into, you know, the feelings of frustration, the feelings of anxiety, everything, you know, very, very much rooted in this process of alienation. But the second, you know, profound implication is what the capitalists do with the productive resources, what their, you know, why it is that they hold them and what it is they do with them. And what they do with them, the only thing that they're interested in with their control of their productive resources is actually profit, is making more profit, is expanding the control that they have, the share that they have of the productive system. So the decisions that they make aren't based in any way on what's actually needed in society, what's actually needed by real, living, breathing human beings. You know, what are the needs? How are we going to provide for those? And we'll, you know, mobilise the productive resources accordingly. The decisions are made on the basis of how that capitalist is going to increase, you know, and get more profit. And that's not because they're bad people. I mean, they are bad people. But they don't do the reason they're doing this is not because they're bad people. The reason they're doing this is because something that's very fundamental to capitalism itself, and that is in order to survive as a capitalist, you need to expand your capital if you're going to survive. It's one or you go bust. You know, like you're in a competitive marketplace competing against other capitals. Unless you can undercut their prices and expand your market share, you'll be driven out of business and you'll be no more. more. So the capitalists don't, yeah, as I said, they don't make their decisions based on what people need. They certainly don't make their decisions just because they're mean and nasty people. They make their decisions to actually survive, you know, to survive as capitalists. And the process, you know, like in terms of what happens to the productive resources in this process, Marx identified there is a logical process that takes place, and that is a growing concentration and centralization of capital in fewer and fewer hands. Smaller firms gobble up bigger firms, who then gobble up bigger firms, who then gobble up bigger firms, you know? And I think, you could... People talk about the 1% and the 99%. I mean, the reality in today's society is like literally like the 0.001%, you know, and the rest of people in terms of, if you want to look at, you know, the tiny, literally hundreds of people controlling, you know, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of resources in terms of, you know, making those decisions about where, you know, where investments are going to go. And then there's the state, you know, the state actors, which will bring in, which I'd argue, again, are essentially the states are controlled by a tiny minority, despite the, you know, appearance or charade of democracy. So there's, you know, there's a... society's needs are not met, you know, on the one hand. You have this complete anarchy in the process of production where these capitalists are just competing against each other. And then there's just the obscene injustices that you see that go along with that are part of it. You know, like, on the one hand, mass homelessness, while on the other hand, huge, you know, housing, you know, houses and office blocks and other things that are completely empty. You know, but under capitalism, there's no way of actually solving that, because those houses, those office blocks are controlled by people who just want profit. They're not interested in housing the people that are, you know, freezing to death on the street. There's the, you know, the starvation. Like, in our world, people starving every single day, every second of every day, people dying of starvation around the world, while literally at the same time, grain is being tipped into the sea because there's, you know, it's a surplus and there's no market. You know, they can't actually sell the grain on a profitable basis, etc. So you have these deep injustices, you know, that are just so glaringly obvious, but because of the way this productive system is actually set up, there's nothing you can do about it because, you know, as I said, the decisions are made on the basis of what's going to profit, not on the basis of what society needs. I mean, the other profound thing that takes place in terms of the way that capitalism is set up is it just consistently goes into crisis and must go into crisis. It's important to say what happens in a crisis. What happens in a crisis is essentially capitalists just stop investing. You know, it's not like there's not work to do. It's not like there aren't needs that are out there. It's not like you wake up one morning and suddenly there's less need for housing, or there's less need for food, or there's less need for clothes. But it is that you wake up one morning and all these capitalists are sitting back saying, we're not going to invest today. We're actually going to hold our money back. And why are we going to hold our money back? Because we're not going to be able to get the return on it that we might like. So it's better for us to actually just sit on this money rather than investing it. And that's what manifests as a recession or as a crisis that leads to all the social ills that go along with that. The mass unemployment, you know, the cutbacks on, you know, on social services, the poverty, you know, everything that's driven by it. And just to touch, you know, slightly on the question of why capitalism goes into crisis. I mean, the question of the falling rate of profits is an entire another talk, but just, you know, really briefly, there's some fundamentals about why these sorts of things happen. You know, and that is that labour, living labour, our labour is actually the source of the capitalist profits, right? If capitalists will sit down, when it's making their calculations for the firm, they need to buy their raw materials, they need to buy their plant, they need to buy their, you know, their capital equipment, and they need to buy their labour. They buy all those things. At the end of the day, there's a product that's produced which they sell for more than what they paid for all of the inputs. Now, why can they sell it for more than what they paid for all the inputs? They can sell it because something's transformed in the process, living labour has entered into the process, has added value to all of those resources, and the capitalist is the one who walks away at the end of the day with the living labour, with the surplus value, what we call a surplus value. But over time, as we've said, when the capitalists need to compete, they need to actually invest more and more in the technological innovations, in the plant, you know, equipment and in the plant materials. So a greater and greater share of what they're investing is in, you know, cutting-edge technology and all these sorts of things that'll undercut their competitor. But at the same time, the proportion that they're spending on living labour is less and less And therefore, the rate of profit is less and less because there's less surplus value actually in the, you know, in the production process for the capitalists. So, you know, over time, Marx says that you have a decrease in the rate of profit. You know, is something that's built into the system and that is actually the underlying tendency which triggers so many of the crises that we've seen throughout the 20th century, which triggered in many ways the crisis, you know, that we're experiencing today. So these things are built in. You know, the other thing, if we want to talk about why capitalism fails. I mean, we're, you know, got a paper full this morning of the, you know, another war's going to happen in Iraq. I gave a talk about this at this conference, quite a few people out, so I won't labour the point too much. But, you know, along with the competition between firms, you know, to get more and more market share, this spills over into geopolitical competition, ruthless geopolitical competition between states. But by the scale of the industrial production that you're talking about by the late 19th century and by the 20th century, when these firms, these massive firms, they require guarantees that the raw materials are going to roll through the door. They require guarantees that the markets are going to be there when they want to actually sell, on the marketplace. They require guarantees that the trade route is going to be secure, that they can actually send that equipment off. You wouldn't invest hundreds of millions of dollars in a production process if those things weren't guaranteed. And to get those guarantees, you need armed force. You need the backing of a state who's actually going to ensure that those things flow smoothly and that you're going to be able to get the raw materials, get the markets, and have the secure trade routes. And that means that these firms that are competing in the international marketplace, there's a process of military competition that actually goes on between the different nation states who are housing those firms. So this too, again, isn't just because, you know, Tony Abbott's a bad guy. He's definitely a bad guy, but he doesn't want to bomb Iraq just for that purpose. He wants to bomb Iraq to project the interests and project the power of Australian capitalist firms on the global stage. He wants to send a clear message to China. He wants to send a clear message to Russia. He wants to send a clear message to the United States, you know, about the particular way that Australia is going to line up and make sure that BHP's shipping routes will be uncontested, that Woodside's gas fields will be secure in Australian hands, because people will fear the power and the military might that's actually behind those firms, you know, in the form of Australian imperialism. So imperialist competition and war, if you want, you know, any confirmation that these things are, you know, are fundamental and built into the system, you only need to look, you know, at the 20th century, the bloodbath of the 20th century, and also at the ongoing things that we see today. I think probably, you know, there's one of the things that illustrates it most graphically in terms of the failures of capitalism is the ecological catastrophe, you know, that has been caused in a whole range of ways, and now is of course posing an existential threat to, you know, human civilization, which is of course climate change. And it gives you an example, I think, of the, you know, of this anarchy that we've been talking about that's in the system, and of just how mad the system really is. I mean, anyone will tell you, including every single capitalist government all around the world, except for maybe Tony Abbott's one, that climate change is real, that the thing, you know, that the thing's in total crisis, that we, you know, that this is going to be catastrophic, the sea level's going to rise, there's going to be billions of refugees, the whole thing's going to go. But every single day they wake up, they pull coal out of the ground, they burn it, they pull oil out of the ground, they burn it, they wake up the next day, they do more, they open up new gas fields, they know the consequences of this. They know full well. But because of the way production is organised and the way the productive decisions happen, those decisions happen for the profits of those individual firms. There's no force in society which can actually say, stop burning the coal now. That would be very nice if we can just stop that and build some of the renewable energy that we need. But I think also, you know, it really shows up the charade of this so-called democracy. I mean, any opinion poll you look at, people want more solar power. You know, I think it was 90% or something I saw the other day of Australians, when they're polled, do you think there should be more solar power? They say yes, because people aren't stupid. Of course there should be more solar power. But where, again, is the social force that will actually be able to deliver that? You know, and all we're allowed to do is debate the question of how we're going to solve climate change within some very strict limits, where the interests of the capitalist class, who actually control the media in which this debate's taking place, who control the parliament in which this debate's taking place, all of the limits are set around which sort of little market mechanism might we be able to put in place that means all the capitalists can continue to make money, and maybe we'll get some small shift to gas and maybe a little bit of wind down there. There's no space in that Sydney Morning Herald. There's no space in the Australian Parliament. There's no space in the Australian newspaper for a discussion that says, how about we actually take all the resources off these guys and build the solar power plants tomorrow that we need? You know, the technology's there, you know, the knowledge is there, we could do it tomorrow, but there's not the political force that can, you know, that can actually deliver it. And that's why I wanted to come onto the question of, you know, the second part of the question that has been framed for the discussion today, and that's what's the alternative? I mean, in some it's, you know, we've got an easy answer. The alternative is socialism, revolutionary socialism. What we mean by revolutionary socialism is that the people that actually participate in the production process, the people that actually do the work, that carry out the labour, the working class, are the ones who should control it. We should have control over what happens with our labour. We should have control over what projects we work on, over where societies, the, you know, incredible, you know, resources that are available in modern society, how they're used, for what purpose they're used. We should be able to say that everyone can have a house, everyone can be properly fed, you know, we can have clean energy tomorrow. These things are all totally possible in technical and practical terms. They're impossible under capitalism, under the system of politics and economy we have under capitalism. We say that workers need to democratically control the means of production, not in some far-off parliament where we elect representatives who go down, you know, and do it for us. Day-to-day in our own workplaces, there should be democratic councils that we participate in. We don't just work, but we also participate in debate and discussion about what the purpose of that work is, about how the goods that we make are going to be distributed, you know, all those, you know, that our vision is for workers' councils, is for democratic control of the productive system. And also for there would be, you know, centralised bodies, centralised parliament, you know, centralised councils, you know, Soviets that coordinate to plan the economy, you know, on a more grand scale, with a vision to what the whole of society needs, with a vision to, you know, to delivering across the board, but the representatives would actually come out of the workplace level, would come out of the democratic, you know, control at the local level of the workplace, and would be accountable to that democratic control, you know, sort of at the local level. So, you know, our vision is for complete democracy, you know, communism, complete democracy, you know, in terms of the decisions that we all make, you know, regain control, take control over what is ours, our living labour and that labour process. That's what we mean by socialism. That's what we're talking about when we talk about socialism. You know, how do you get there? That's the question. You know, it would be very nice if we were there now. But I think just in terms of, don't have too much time for the discussion, but there's been two major polls, I think, like in terms of, I mean, leave aside for a question the question of Stalinism. I mean, that could hopefully come up in the discussion. You know, the fact that there were a whole range of regimes during the 20th century that took the mantle of socialism, but there was precisely the same alienation in those societies in terms of people not, there were dictatorships. These were, you know, state control of the economy, not democratic people's control of the economy. And we can have some discussion about that. But in terms of what I want to finish on, the two sort of poles in terms of how we get, you know, to this socialist society that have, you know, traditionally been there is, on one hand, there's a reformist vision. They say, well, all these policies make really good sense, right? You like what I'm saying, we should all have houses, we should all have food, we should have clean energy. That's all really good. Why don't you just stand for Parliament? Why don't we just stand for Parliament, get elected, we'll go down to the Parliament and we'll make the law that will build clean energy and everyone will have houses and, you know, that makes sense, right? There's a Parliament, there's a democracy, there's an election process. You know, we'll just, you know, that's known as reformism. You know, we can reform the system, we can go in and take government and, you know, and do it. I mean, there's the two problems with that. You know, the first is that whenever any serious movement that is seriously challenging, you know, the status quo in terms of the interests of the ruling class starts to emerge within Parliament, it will be very, very ruthlessly fought against by the ruling class who actually own and control the reins of power. And there's plenty of examples in the 20th century of when reformist governments have been elected only for there to be things like military coups or, you know, even on some sort of, you know, smaller scale, you know, manipulation of the press and lies and, you know, slander and everything mobilised to try and eject, you know, reformist parties from the parliament. But in the more extreme examples, such as Chile, as soon as you got a government, you know, in Chile in the early 70s that was saying the sorts of things, we're going to have socialism, that, you know, the ruling class shows its true face, they have a coup, they turf them out, and they hold on to the factories, which has always been the source of their power. So for us, looking at that history, looking at those experiences, we say you're not just going to be able to go to Parliament, you know, and make these reforms. They're things that are going to have to be forced. We're going to have to extract those resources from the ruling class. We're going to have to take control, physically take control, and militarily defend, you know, the taking control of the means of production that are currently being held, you know, by that tiny capitalist elite. So that's the first thing about it. The second thing is, though, is that the process of democracy, the process of thoroughgoing democracy that we're talking about, you know, is actually something that we all have to learn to be able to do. It's not something, I mean, in theory, yes, we could wake up tomorrow and do, but, you know, it's only really through a process of struggle. It's through an intense process of struggle. It's through confronting these questions collectively, as a mass, as a movement, dealing with all the challenges, you know, in the process of struggle, that the working class is actually going to be able to learn, you know, and get the vision and the foresight and the understanding of the social dynamics and conditions that are around them to rule. You know, it's through, and I think we see this time, and that's why it's the self-emancipation of the working class that'll deliver socialism. It's not some elite sitting down in a parliament somewhere that'll deliver it. People themselves are going to have to be the masters of the world. People themselves are going to have to come to understand all the dynamics that are going on in terms of, you know, global politics, local politics, all the dynamics. People are going to have to learn, you know, that, and it's through struggle and through fighting back against the system that is really the schoolhouse, you know, for that learning. And I think any of us that have participated in protest movements know that, you know, it's being part of a mass demonstration, you know, can teach you so much, you know, about your own power, can give you inspiration. You learn about what the media, you know, is really like when they print the lies the next day. You learn about what the police are really like when they charge in, you know, and smash you. Being part of a strike, you can learn even so much more. You can learn about your own power at the point of production. You can understand the extent to which the capitalists will squeal when you stop working collectively and when you actually turn that tap off, you know, that they rely on to suck their surplus values. So that's why we look, you know, not to Parliament to say, you know, to transform the society, but to people themselves and to a process of social struggle. And, you know, every single little injustice that capitalism, you know, throws on us, there's resistance to. You know, if it was small scale, hidden sometimes, open sometimes, bursting out in mass mobilisation sometimes. And, you know, we're part of an organisation that wants to be involved in every single one of those struggles, learn the lessons from every single one of those struggles, and link up every single one of those struggles into a big conflagration that can actually take the system out, you know, as a whole. But it is going to be a learning process, and it's one through struggle that, as Marx said, that makes the working class fit to rule. It's a self-emancipation, the process of struggle, you know, out of those, you know, democratic moments, those liberatory moments that we, you know, all look to and, you know, and get so much from, you know, in the campaigns and struggles that we're involved in, you know, that are the seeds of the real democratic, you know, control of the system, a revolutionary socialist world that we aspire to and that we fight for.